This episode of Women with Balls is sponsored by Alliance Witten Investment Trust. From the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s, the financial crash in 2008, to the COVID epidemic and Liz Truss's doomed premiership, there has been no shortage of economic crises over the last 58 years. And yet, throughout that time, every single year, without fail, we've paid out an increased dividend to our shareholders. In fact, Alliance Witten's history dates all the way back to 1888. And today, we manage around £5 billion in assets. If you're looking for a less stressful way to invest in stocks and shares, learn more about Alliance Witten and find your comfort zone.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Ball, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today is one of the most influential figures in British fashion and fashion journalism. She began her career as a journalist working for publications including Tatler, The Sunday Telegraph and GQ. But she is best known for her time at British Vogue, where, as a longest-serving editor-in-chief, she transformed the magazine and increased its circulation to record figures. After stepping down in 2017, she has been a columnist, author and commentator, speaking on the changing landscape of media and fashion. She has written candidly about her leadership style, her thoughts on the industry's evolving values, and the challenges of balancing commercial success with editorial integrity. My guest today is Alexandra Shulman. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. Delighted to have you. On this podcast, we ask everyone the same question and are sometimes accused of trying to be a therapist on a couch. Would you describe yours as a happy childhood?
I would describe mine as a happy childhood, yes. I mean, it's funny, sort of, as you get older, and I've got two siblings, it emerges what everybody thinks about their childhood more and more. But I regarded it as a pretty happy childhood, yeah.
And you grew up in West London, I think.
No, Central London, actually, not far from these offices.
So does that mean, as you kind of branched out and met more people outside your school friends and others, that you're one of those people who grew up quite quickly, I would say? I just remember going to university and everyone who grew up in London seemed to know things that we did not.
Difficult to answer because I was in London, so I didn't have a comparison. But I guess, yeah, you were definitely urban and I think probably in a way a bit kind of snotty and feeling like we did know more and we were a bit more grown up, you know, a bit more sophisticated. My dad was a theatre critic for the Evening Standard for, you know, something like 47 years, I mean, really long time. And my mum was a journalist all her life and she's still alive. She's in fact just about to be 98. So I was brought up in a very, very kind of deep, immersed journalistic household.
Does that mean you were reading publications from quite an early age? And for example, which ones were on your mind? Was Vogue an early one or were you all across?
So our house was just filled with magazines and newspapers. I always remember when one of my friends from school came round. She only came once, actually. And she just went back and she said to her mother, "I've never been in such a messy house in my life." And it was just piles of paper and books. And we had all the daily papers. So, you know, once I got to kind of teenager, I was reading them, some of them at breakfast. My mum was working on magazines at that point, but Vogue was very much in the household. And then our dad used to take us out on Saturday morning when we were children, and our treat was to go and buy a comic on W.H. Smith's in Sloane Square. So I think we got the kind of, yeah, we got the bug. There was a newsstand outside. We knew the news seller and everything. I think we got the bug early.
Did you have a sense quite early on that you would have a career in journalism? Because also sometimes when parents try and impose something on you, almost rebel against it. I struggle to climb mountains to this day, not just because of fitness, but because I went on non-stop climbing holidays in my youth.
Bit like you, actually. The last thing I wanted to do was be a journalist. It struck me as a rather badly paid and rather hard-working career. But I did think it was fun. I did think they had a nice time. They met interesting people. But I tried hard, quite hard, not to be a journalist. But in the end, it's sort of, once I actually got a job on a magazine, which was a temping job, secretarial job, I kind of realised I'd come home, you know?
And that first job, can you talk us through? So was it called Over 21 Magazine?
Yeah, so it was Over 21 Magazine and I was hired to be secretary to the editor, was my title. And I was temp because Shirley Lowe, who is my boss, who is a wonderful ex-Fleet Street journalist who taken over this magazine at that point, thought that I'd be too bored by being her secretary. So she said, you can come until I find the perfect person. But turned out I was pretty well the perfect person. We got on really well. And it was a really great thing to do because we sat opposite each other and I learned everything about her job, you know, and I did the accounts, I answered the phones, I watched her edit copy, commission people, all the contributors came in. So I thought, gosh, this is not a bad job to have. So from that point onwards, then I tried to stay in journalism.
I suppose for listeners, can you just set out what the industry was like at that time? Because obviously we're currently, and probably since I started studying journalism, in the era of cuts, magazines going bust or closing, circulation problems. Obviously, there's a digital transition, but generally speaking, we often hear about the heyday. Was this the heyday?
My over 21 days were not the heyday. No, it was the early 80s. But by the later 80s, it was a fantastic time to be a young woman in journalism because there were just all these new launches, not just in magazine journalism, but also things like TVAM. There were new channels opening up. All the newspapers started to have more supplements. I went to work for the Sunday Telegraph and I was called women's page editor. And I was like 26. Well, I don't think you'd get a job like that now, but everybody wanted a young editor, even though I knew that Perry Worthorn, who was the editor of the Sunday Telegraph, had absolutely no idea what I did and had no particular desire to have me on the team. But it's kind of what you got told to do. And then in the 90s, then there was another, after a sort of recession in the early 90s, then I think it became really the kind of heyday of the glossy magazines. So I was really lucky.
And during that period, I mean, obviously we have limited time, but I don't want to miss key parts of your career. But I think one of the quite interesting things was your time at GQ. Obviously, you know, a woman at a men's magazine, there was a demand for women. But how was that as a thing? I briefly interned at FHM, if that counts for anything.
I think FHM was very hardcore. GQ wasn't the same. And it was great. I mean, once I think everyone on the team there had got over the fact that I was given the job because I wasn't the first editor, but the first editor didn't last very long. So I was sort of the second editor within a year. And they were probably a little bit wary of me coming in. But I think with GQ and again with Vogue, what I realized is you didn't have to know your subject matter. You only had to appreciate those that did. So, you know, if I've got any talent, it's hiring people. I'm really good at hiring people. So I got a really good team on GQ and I loved working at GQ. I was only there for about nearly 2 years, but, you know, I would have stayed forever if the Vogue job hadn't come up.
And I was about to ask you, which is a million-dollar question, but what are the key skills of an editor, which you slightly answered there? An editor, do you think an editor has to have very strong opinions, or is it more that sense of nurturing talent and accepting where you know a bit less?
My experience are both. I mean, I think you can be either. You're either somebody, which I think I was, a bit like a conductor of an orchestra, and you sort of see your role as, in theory, encouraging and bringing people in to do the bits that they're good at. And other people do have sort of, it's kind of my way or the highway, and they edit that way. But that wasn't what I did.
Now, you mentioned Vogue, so let's get to it. You're quite young when you get your Vogue job.
Yeah, 34.
What was the process for it? And was it one of those pinch yourself moments when it was announced?
Well, the awful truth is I don't really remember. my boyfriend at the time, who then did become my husband, although we're no longer together, he has a very different memory than me. He sort of remembers us sitting in Pizza Express and putting together some kind of document and pitching, which I have no recollection at all of.
You don't even remember the pizza you had.
I remember where it was, Shepherd's Bush Green, but probably a margarita. It was a weird thing because I never thought that I would edit Vogue. It wasn't my great ambition at all. And it was only in some strange way where I began to hear people say, well, aren't you going to try and get Vogue? And you'd be really good at Vogue. And then there was sort of, because newspapers at that point were really interested in who was going to edit Vogue, so there'd be all these kind of things about who's in the running. And I thought, crikey, well, maybe it's really wet not to try, at least. So I was already in the company and they knew me and they knew I'd done a good job at GQ. So it wasn't like coming in cold.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it wasn't that difficult. Ah, I know. But the key thing is I was not first choice. I wasn't first choice. I wasn't second choice. I was third choice. The first two had turned it down.
And did you know at the time of accepting that they turned it down, or did you find out later?
I think I knew at the time of accepting, yeah.
Because I know some people who have not taken jobs because they have found that someone else turned it down and that was denting to their ego, which I've never quite understood.
No, absolutely not. Because you kind of feel, well, you know, they need me.
Yeah, exactly. And also accept a job and make the others regret it.
Yeah.
So what was it like entering Vogue House? And
well, again, that wasn't odd because I'd worked on Vogue as features editor for 2 years before going to GQ.
So did you have quite a warm reception, would you say?
In the Vogue offices? No, not particularly. I think it was a bit that kind of weird thing where, you know, it was a very different time. Features and fashion were very separate. So nobody in the fashion room had anything to do with anybody who wasn't to do with fashion and vice versa. So the people that I'd worked with, of which there were still some there, on the whole, did like me, though, you know, probably a bit wary, but they did like me. The fashion room, who knew that I'd been sitting in this other sort of the other side of the wall, as it were, for 2 years and had nothing to do with the world that they were involved in, they were not particularly welcoming at all. No, absolutely not. That was tough, taking on the Vogue fashion room and Vogue fashion when you knew nothing about fashion, which was the case with me.
And did you feel, maybe a silly question, did you feel you had to suddenly dress differently as Vogue editor?
Everybody asked me that.
That would be one of the things that would keep me up at night.
I did think I probably needed to get some new clothes.
From the fashion cupboard, surely.
Not from the fashion cupboard. They're all sample size. And I had bought something for my kind of job interview, which was a kind of black jacket, and all the pictures of me when I got the job, I'm all in this kind of weird black jacket with zips all over. I didn't really feel I had to dress differently, but I was aware of the fact that I didn't dress in a very kind of knowing fashion way. But to be honest, it was kind of the last thing on my mind. I think had I realised that people were going to pay so much attention to what I wore, I would have been much more worried. It just never entered my head that that was going to be a thing people would talk about.
And now, given I've asked you a question everyone has asked you, I'm also going to ask you another really obvious question, and I hope you just forgive me, which is just, obviously lots of people have seen The Devil's Wear, The Devil Wears Prada. What likeness to no likeness did it have to your experience?
Very, very little. The Devil Wears Prada is definitely a kind of fictional film. I mean, there are brilliant moments in it where you do see that thing of people being obsessed with fashion and the handbags and things like that. But it really was not my life or like my life or like anybody I knew's life.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you boosted circulation. What were the kind of key steps you took when you look back at your time? And obviously you had a very, very long stretch as editor.
Yeah, an ancient, sort of surprising I'm still alive. Well, it was to do with the time, which was that until I got to Vogue, really, fashion magazines were quite kind of rarefied. There was a relatively small sort of international fashion industry that was very, very fashion. And then during the time I came to Vogue, the high street opened up and new magazines like Marie Claire launched and all the newspapers had fashion supplements. And so I decided we had to broaden Vogue, that we couldn't be quite so kind of high-end and recherche. We had to sort of have a lot of things in that spoke to, I guess, real people and what their shopping choices were and different price points. So I wanted it to speak to me as a person who is buying clothes and thinking of style. But also, when I was growing up, I'd never thought of Vogue as a fashion magazine particularly. I'd thought of it as a magazine where you saw great stories about singers and artists and theatre directors. So I really wanted it to be a kind of cultural magazine.
Are there particular covers that you look back on and, well, A, the ones you're most proud of, but are there any where you're like, wasn't the best?
lots of covers were not the best, because the thing about covers is that in some ways you have relatively little control because you, you know, you send this team out there, you've maybe got an actor or an actress or a model even, and a photographer.
Yeah.
And you've got that afternoon. And then what comes in is not what you had in mind. I think the one that I feel the most strongly about that was when we photographed Adele. And I'd really wanted to photograph Adele sort of to show her body because she was big, and I'd wanted to kind of celebrate that you could be this amazing talent and be on Vogue. But and then what came back were a whole load of headshots, and that was just so heartbreaking to me. But a lot of the covers I really liked. I don't have I can't remember how many there were now, but it must have been about 300, so...
Was Adele happy with her Vogue cover?
I think she was quite happy, yeah. She was wearing Burberry, I remember that, but you couldn't see it.
Just on the subject of kind of models and size, that was one of the things that you did state that you wanted, you know, not to move it, I suppose, to your everyday person, but to move it away from some of the more skeletal images. Do you think you succeeded in that? And do you think that's maintained now you're gone?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it was, I wrote this letter that's sort of now become well known to all the designers saying we had to do something about the sample sizes that they produced for us to shoot people in, because it meant that we had to sort of only have very skinny people in the magazines, or otherwise they had to kind of squeeze into something and sort of be clipped at the back, or, you know. But today I read a piece that my ex fashion features writer Lisa Armstrong, who in the Telegraph wrote about, quoting that, but writing about, you know, the cult of skinniness now, and at the magazine, some of the film awards, how very, very thin all the actresses are looking. And now you've got the Ozempic thing. So as well as people already wanting to be thin, now everybody can be thin. And I think everybody being able to be thin means some people want to be even more thin. And it's so depressing. Yeah. It never shifts. This narrative never shifts.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Ozempic, because do you think, because obviously technically you're only supposed to take it if you're a certain weight, but we all know some people who are taking Ozempic. And I presume there are some in the fashion industry and models taking Ozempic. Is it now more morally acceptable to be super skinny because it's through a drug rather than, I don't know, some kind of disorder? Or is it still, do you think, probably quite unhealthy, particularly given you're not meant to take these drugs on their weights?
Well, I don't know that it was ever morally unacceptable to be very thin. In terms of sort of...
I suppose I mean more the lifestyle choices, some who aren't naturally very thin might take it.
I think it's probably now people almost think, well, why wouldn't you? You know, if you've got this option, why wouldn't you? Which I find personally very unpleasant, because I think the idea that we have a culture where now you're kind of, it's becoming the norm. It's a bit like Botox, which I also think about this, about, you know, where you're encouraged to use interventions in order to change your appearance, which then makes it that much harder for everybody to accept how they are. And bottom line is, you know, if you're not unhealthily overweight, you know, you should just be content, just be happy.
Now I want to talk about obviously your decision to leave Vogue and I'm next, but I suppose just during your tenure at Vogue, obviously there was more of a shift to digital. And how did you find that when it comes to obviously glossy magazines and what they were and making that transition?
Digital Vogue, it's sort of Vogue.com, it started, actually it was Vogue.co.uk, but, you know, quite early on. And it took a long time until the website and the magazine sort of merged. But by the time I left, we were sort of trying to collaborate, I would say. But it was still, that was 7 years ago, and it was still kind of an effort. It wasn't the kind of seamless thing it is now, where everyone just accepts that you're producing, I like to say stories, but I know it's content, which can be used anywhere. I always thought that for Vogue, the fact that you lost the incredible visuals was a real problem for digital. But the ability to react to things very quickly was very exciting. And yeah, and we started to do Vogue video, which was great, and things like that.
What made you decide that you'd had enough time at Vogue?
In 2016, it was Vogue's 100th anniversary, centenary. And we had this incredible year. We had an exhibition at National Portrait Gallery. We did a documentary, two-part documentary, which was sort of less fabulous, but anyway, on BBC. And
I think there's been offers to you on The Spectator over the years, but wisely, the reason we've not all been cancelled.
Clear. I know. I think it was not one of my most brilliant decisions, that one. We did books and the magazine sold really well and everything. And I was actually really happy because it had all gone so well. And then I did literally wake up one morning and I thought, you know, if there's ever a good time to leave, it's now. And I suddenly could see that if I stayed, I was going to have this kind of glorious past, but I wasn't going to have any different future. And if I left, I would have a future. I didn't know what it was. And it was literally a kind of overnight decision, you know, as a kind of Damascus conversion in the middle of the night. And once I'd made that decision, I just couldn't wait to resign. And actually, I had to wait to resign for various reasons. And then when I did resign, I had to stay for another 6 months because that's what they wanted. But from the moment I wanted to leave, I wanted to leave.
So you leave, and you leave on your terms. And as you say, at that point where not lots of people don't get this quite right, you leave when everything is actually going very well. Mm. but then, of course, your successor, Edward Enninful, is appointed. And then it feels as though there's a new narrative around your time at Vogue, and it becomes a bit of the, you know, the posh woman narrative. Was that strange, kind of seeing
Enninful? It was more than strange. It was absolutely appalling. I was really upset about what happened. And I'd been asked to stay for 6 months, and yet Edward was appointed as the new editor. I think it was in April. So I had sort of April, May, June with him as editor. And where normally that might happen, that person has nothing to do with the magazine for various reasons to do with relationships. He was kind of allowed to start hiring and firing while I was still in the position. So that was really ghastly. And then I offered to leave to the company, and I said, look, you know, you've got your editor now and he knows what he wants to do, doesn't want to do the same thing as me, so, you know, why don't I just shuffle off? And they were like, no, you agreed to stay 6 months. And so I saw my kind of office undermined while I was there. But at that point, I didn't yet know about, you know, the posh white narrative that was then going to spring up as a way of kind of differentiating Edward's Vogue from my Vogue. I mean, at the time, it was incredibly hurtful. And I thought, God, I've been at this magazine for 25 years and now nobody in the company is trying to kind of, you know, defend what I'd done. But now I realise that that's what always happens. Anybody that leaves a job, somebody takes over, and the first thing they do is undermine what that person's done before. The first thing they do is say they've done everything wrong. You know, hadn't they realised this? Hadn't they realised that?
I mean, I think one of the things with your successor's Vogue was talked about, you know, the magazine was more diverse. Do you think a fashion magazine, and it might, obviously it's more than just fashion, should be diverse? Is that one of the things they should be aiming for?
Well, I think everything should be diverse. Yeah. Yeah, I see no reason why a fashion magazine shouldn't be. Now, if you're talking about racially diverse, I think, you know, you had to look at, that was very much Edward's specific agenda, which is what, you know, what he wanted to do. And I had no problems with him doing that. And I think we have seen a huge cultural shift. I mean, it wasn't just Vogue, but, you know, you look at all the theatre casting, you know, and colourblindness and everything. And that, I think that's all to the good.
Do you still read Vogue? You know, when you've done something for so long, is it almost tricky to kind of to read it and almost enjoy it as a consumer and a reader without thinking, oh, I would have done X, I would have done Y? Does that stop after a while?
So I have always read Vogue. I kind of felt like I'd done so much of my life immersed, it would be sad not to be interested in Vogue. I have to say I like Choma, who's now the editorial director of Vogue, more than I like Edward's Vogue, because I think it's gone back to the idea of having sort of better writing and a bit of a broader mix in it. But I can't look at it just like, you know, I'll read The Spectator or The New Yorker, or I'll look at World of Interiors, and that's kind of just indulgence and interest. I can't look at it quite like that.
Not quite the switching off read.
No.
And as where things are now, I mean, obviously you write regular columns and things. How do you fill your time? And do you enjoy having almost like a portfolio career?
Yes, I really like it. I mean, so I'm very lucky that I got offered Notebook on the Mail on Sunday because it gives me a kind of spine to the week. I know what I'm doing some of the week always.
Some structure.
And also you kind of know that you're employed. So you're not quite sort of flailing around in the wind. But, you know, any day, who knows? And I love the fact that, like, I'm a trustee at the Wallace Museum. So yesterday was a day spent with all the trustees and the chair, a sort of strategy day. And then I'm working on a project with a friend of mine, which is a writing project, which is very exciting. And done a bit of kind of volunteering in the local library, actually, and things like that. So I love that mix. And I love the freedom to organize your own agenda. But obviously, you know, I had a life that was really structured and I had a paycheck at the end of the month. And that
I presume
was
you had an assistant, for example.
I had two assistants, yep, and tons of help and executive cars. And I've only just begun to realize how expensive going out to lunch is because I never had to pay. so there were lots of nice things.
Was it weird initially when you ended? We've had plenty of, you know, government ministers on the, and former government ministers on this podcast. And, you know, obviously you get the ministerial car and then you find out you're sacked or you've lost the election. And they do talk about that adjustment, which I'm not saying is quite the same, but is it quite strange to go from obviously two assistants, office life, to suddenly like, what am I going to do with my day?
Because I'd thought about it and then I did have that 6 months. It wasn't that strange to me. I did quite a lot of saying to my incredibly nice assistants for that 6 months, you've got to teach me how to do this. I've got to learn how to do Google Doc.
Yeah, I need to know.
Yeah, I need to know how to look after myself.
Just a final two questions for me. I suppose we talked about fashion journalism more broadly. How do you see the state of the industry now? Do you think there's kind of lots of reasons for optimism, or do you think we're heading to a world where, you know, there is a market for clicks or subs or positivity levels?
Well, it's hard to ignore the kind of, you know, the click mentality, because obviously that is something that people are focusing on and that kind of appeals to the lowest common denominator. But I have a feeling, just looking at figures and things like subscriptions from some of the newspapers and things, that actually I think it is almost a bit of a swing back to having a more measured attitude to that you can't only be writing about, you know, porn stars and keep your readership. And the other thing I've noticed is how successful kind of niche magazines are, things that are very, very specific and really good on that subject, seem to be able to survive quite well. Little independent magazines, they don't make a fortune, but they do make something.
Yeah, there is a model out there.
Yeah.
And then finally, this is a question we ask everyone, which is, what is the worst advice you've ever been given? And I feel in your long career, you must have been given quite a lot of bad advice. Not that you necessarily listen to it.
I know the advice that I didn't pay any attention to, if you'd like that, which is actually
please.
When I left Vogue and I was given an executive coaching session as a favour by somebody, and I saw these guys in an executive coaching room and they said to me, so when you leave Vogue, you know, what are you going to say about your experience? And I'm going to say, well, it was absolutely wonderful. And what are you going to say about, you know, the future of Vogue? And I'm going to say, it's very, very encouraging. It's all going to be great. And they said, no, you are going to say nothing at all. You are never going to talk about Vogue because whatever you say will be twisted in some way. So I didn't pay any attention to that.
And with that, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.